Welcome to Crescent City Crime, dear listeners. I'm Tracy.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome back. Happy New Year. If you are a new listener that has somehow found us, we're very happy you're here. Welcome.
Welcome, new listener. Happy New Year.
And thank you to everybody who has been following us on Instagram and the new Facebook members that we have gained. We're so happy to have you as a part of our group.
Welcome to the party, pal.
So it has been a little while since we had a proper coffee talk episode. And dear listeners, we're not going to lie to you. Our December kind of sucked.
Yes, it really did.
So, first of all, we just have to tell you that we were getting kicked out of our rental in favor of an Airbnb. Yes, that has now happened to us.
Yeah, it's been a problem in New Orleans. Choice locations like where we are in this lovely part of Mid-City have been, areas where many out-of-state interests have opened Airbnbs.
Yeah.
And a recent court ruling, the result of which is that, it's affected us, the result of which is that if the area is zoned commercial and residential, then it does not have to be owner-occupied. In other words, the owner doesn't have to live on the other side.
Right.
Like an Airbnb is supposed to work. It's not supposed to be owned by some corporation from out of state and basically, turned into a mini hotel.
But we have managed to get our own place, a place of our very own. So we are in the process of moving, which I really hate moving.
Yeah, moving is no fun, especially if you've been where we've been for 9 years.
Yes, we've been in this house for quite a while. This will be one of the last episodes that we record in this house. And in an effort to just sort of lighten the mood, we're going to start the year off with a coffee talk episode, a topic that is tied to a crime, and it is a very interesting topic. So make sure, dear listeners, that you are following us on all the socials. We will link everything in our, I will link everything in the show notes, of course, like how I always do, and you can find us on all of the social medias. And if you are not subscribed to us on YouTube, please do so. Because, with the podcast, when you create an episode, it kicks out the episode through an RSS feed to all these different platforms. YouTube is the only place that I am directly in control of the uploading. So you can always subscribe to us on YouTube. I do put the episodes up there every Friday. And of course, tell everybody you know about us. Tell your family, tell your friends, and of course,
tell your enemies, especially your enemies.
Yes, threaten them with a good time of listening to this podcast. Now, are you ready to get to the episode proper today?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, there are many types of predators in the world, right? But what we don't always think about is the predatory nature of certain types of plants. Dear listeners, wherever you live, you probably have a lot of greenery around your house, but have you ever wondered where does it all come from, right? Back when certain plants were brought to America, people had no idea the trouble they could cause. One such example is kudzu. Kudzu is an invasive plant species in the United States. It was introduced from Asia with devastating environmental consequences, and it has the nickname, the vine that ate the South. In fact, in some of the larger southern cities, such as Atlanta, they have to have a kudzu crew, essentially, which keeps it at bay, because if not, that vine will just grow on everything, and, well, there would be no more Atlanta as we know it today.
Yeah, I didn't think there was any Atlanta left.
Oh, stop it.
Boy.
Yeah. So, water hyacinth plants are another example, and it will be the central plant discussed in this episode. If you travel through a Louisiana swamp, you're going to see all sorts of flora and fauna, and you'll probably see these beautiful flowering plants in the waterways. And these are called water hyacinths. They were bought to New Orleans in 1884, distributed as gifts by the Japanese delegation to an international cotton exposition. These pale lavender flowers were planted as decorations around the city, and they multiplied and spread through local waterways and formed these huge mats that would drift towards the mouth of the Mississippi River, and these plants have the potential to clog up that waterway permanently. And of course, once it starts to grow and everything underneath it will die because it can't get sunlight or oxygen. So this invasive species is this way all over the world. Like New Orleans is not, or Louisiana is not the only place that this is a problem. So these mats, like I said, they shade out other aquatic plants, and the decaying process depletes the amount of dissolved oxygen in the water. In the early 1900s, they started to become an issue. And this was also a time in American history where immigration was exploding and cities were expanding. The influx of citizens was causing a national meat shortage. The meat industry was expanding, but it wasn't able to yet keep up with the demands of the population. Now, Brian, what do you think the solution to this was, or the proposed solution?
I don't know.
Would you believe me if I told you hippopotamus ranching?
That's right. I had heard of that before.
Okay. Well, the United States Congress thought that this would address both problems. The idea was that you could harness land that wasn't productive for cattle grazing, like swamps and bayous. So they transplant the hippos into environments that are similar to their native habitats. And, you know, they would eat up all the plants, and apparently you could eat hippos, which I've never eaten hippo. I don't know if people have ever eaten hippo. I assume it's happened somewhere, but I will tell you that in Louisiana, we eat almost everything else. So I would assume that we would eat hippo had it been introduced back during this time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nutri-Rat, awesome.
Squirrels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's meet the people who were behind this plan. A Louisiana congressman named Robert Broussard consulted with two other men. One was Frederick Russell Burnham. The Boy Scouts were founded in his image to create boys that were as capable and honorable as him. And fun fact, he was the inspiration for Indiana Jones. Like if you look at pictures of this guy, you would see where the fedora comes from, the strong jawline, you know, this that kind of swagger, like you can see when you look at photos of this guy. Okay. Now, he was a freelance adventurer, and he went to Africa to fight for the British colonists because, like a lot of people at the time, he thought that this was a noble kind of project to bring civilization to Africa. And he was once described as the most complete human being who ever lived. What an interesting title to have.
Yeah.
Now, the other man was Fritz Duquesne. He was a Boer, which is the descendants of Dutch settlers in Africa. And he moved through life using several aliases. He was a virtuosic and ambitious con man. He fought against the British in the Second Boer War, and he gained notoriety for creating the Duquesne spy ring and faking his own death only later to change his mind and return. Fascinating character.
Yeah, no kidding.
Burnham once called him the human epitome of sin and deception. And during the Boer War, the two men were assigned to kill each other. Okay.
Yes. You can't write this stuff.
Well, you can't make this stuff up, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, together, these three men started the New Food Supply Society to explore and promote their idea of bringing hippopotamuses to Louisiana. Congressman Broussard introduced H.R. 23261, also known as the Hippo Bill, which sought the, which sought the appropriation of $250,000 to import hippos into the United States. Citizens loved this idea. The taste of hippo was touted in an editorial in the New York Times as Lake Cow Bacon.
Oh, wow. Right,
Lake Cow Bacon. And the Washington Post announced that the hippopotamus would be readily available within the United States in a matter of years. When Broussard introduced the bill, the hyacinths had been a problem for at least a decade. They were killing fish, hogging the oxygen, blanketing rivers and waterways. The hyacinth had destroyed fishermen's livelihoods and transformed some of the state's greatest resources into a chain of stinking dead zones. The War Department got involved. They would clean out a stream, and in a month, it would be covered all over again with the same plant.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. The congressional hearings were followed by a surge of excited publicity. Hippopotamy for Dixie, one headline read. The Chicago Tribune covered the proceedings right above the news that Delmonico's, the famous steakhouse, had been forced to raise the price of everything on its menu due to dwindling meat supplies. Another story speculated that because full-grown hippopotamuses would be too large to profitably ship to the stockyards in Chicago, smaller slaughterhouses would have to be built on site, creating a cluster of local food systems and breaking the meat production monopoly. And I also need to point out that this period of history was only 4 years after Upton Sinclair's The Jungle was published, which exposed the horrendous abuses of that monopoly. Like, for example, workers sometimes slipping and falling into rendering tanks, and then their bodies were churned into scraps and sold as lard.
Yeah, or become part of hot dogs.
Yes,
yeah.
all kinds of horrible things that happened before we had workers' rights.
And before you had the FDA, you'd have, you did have like government inspectors, but they weren't held to any real standards. A lot of times, pigs that were sick would get past the inspectors because the inspectors would be distracted one way or another, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally.
Now,
no safety standards.
No safety standards, no OSHA.
Yeah, the rabid industrialism that actually started up north before the Civil War began.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Congress would not act on Broussard's appropriation bill before the end of the session. It was introduced, but Broussard, Burnham, and Duquesne believed that with the right legwork, a reintroduced version would breeze through the House votes. And so, this is how the New Food Supply Society was born, or the concept of it. Shortly after the hearing, the congressman invited Duquesne and Burnham down to his plantation in Louisiana to hash out the plans, and they would continue correspondence in the months afterwards. Now, through these letters, a fourth man, who was allegedly a New York City-based writer and inventor named Elliot Lord, also became involved. Within 2 days of the hearing, he was writing to Burnham, claiming to have already rounded up some of the most powerful members of the House of Representatives for the group's organizing committee and detailing what his own duties in the organization should be. Now, what do you think of that? Just Johnny Come Lately guy who was not even in on the original plan magically starts writing letters.
Sounds like there's ulterior motive involved.
Of course there is. Of course there is. His rapid fire letters came on a series of random letterheads like John A. Stewart, president of the Carbonating Company of America, or Huff and Coryell Underwritten Securities, or the Republican League of Clubs.
Sounds pretty contrived. Kind of reminiscent of how Samuel Colt, the famous gun inventor, had given himself the rank of colonel.
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah.
When he was never a colonel. In fact, he was never an officer. Just like you had Elvis, his manager, give himself the rank of colonel too, Colonel Parker.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He was never even in the army. The irony of which is Elvis had served in the army in Germany.
Yes, he did.
But this Colonel Parker was never a colonel either.
Did Colonel Sanders do that too?
I think so.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he repeatedly nagged Burnham to ask a mining magnate he knew from his days in Africa to bankroll this organization. Burnham was suspicious of Elliot Lord. He also thought that Lord's rashness and money grubbing was irritating. He described him to a friend as flighty and without any financial balance. Now, Burnham was ready to forward the society's goals, and he did ask friends for financing, and he gave speeches to groups of influential sportsmen and naturalists that he did have access to. But he wanted to see a real plan in place first. He imagined that the new food supply society would become a permanent and valuable branch of the nation's new conservation movement. He wrote to Broussard, "I do not wish to go amongst my friends and ask for their names for a society that is soon to go the way of so many abortive congresses and federations and high-sounding things mentioned about twice in a Sunday paper and then forgotten." And Broussard agreed with him. But Elliot Lord did not relent. Throughout the summer, he kept claiming to have an increasingly impressive roster of dignitaries ready to become charter members of the New Food Supply Society. He said that he was going to send Duquesne as an agent of the society on a lecture tour of Ivy League colleges and then the leading seaside and mountain hotels. So this guy is trying to claim that he knows all these people in high society.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's no surprise. Someone who's trying to gain status as pretty much a hack.
It's also a lot harder to verify things back in this time period. Not like today.
Yeah, back then it was easier to make claims. But of course you had to eventually deliver.
Right.
On what you yourself promised, you eventually had to demonstrate some type of competence.
Right. Now, this New Food Supply Society was still just a concept. It did not really exist yet. So again and again in letters, Elliot Lord begged Broussard to incorporate it. He even went so far as to compose one of these letters to Broussard on a sheet of New Food Supply Society letterhead. In the upper left corner, Lord listed Broussard as chairman of the society and himself as a secretary.
Of course, you could create any kind of letterhead you wanted back then.
Well, you still can.
That is true, except that it's easier to vet.
It is easier
to vet claims these days, even though there's there's a lot of companies that aren't bothering to vet people these days, and that's another discussion.
That's true. Now, in this letter, he said, my compensation can be arranged for after the society is funded.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Very arrogant.
Yeah. Right?
All right, so we are going to tell more of the story after this quick break. And we are back. Now, during this time, Duquesne was actually doing work. He went on a fact-finding mission to Louisiana, and he hoped that his role as a freelance hippo expert might soon turn into a legitimate job. He wrote articles about these animals for newspapers and made sure that members of the New Food Society saw his work. However, he wasn't being compensated for his efforts. Burnham did try to encourage him. He said, my dear captain, you certainly are pushing your part of the society in advance of the rest of us. And he told him that he would try to get Lord and Broussard to finally hammer out some financial arrangement and employ Duquesne properly. Duquesne replied to Burnham that he was tired of Lord's glowing promises, and he says, I do not want this movement to die through undue satisfaction or dry rot. In the following months, Burnham tried to keep optimism up. He did write to acquaintances about this idea, and he scheduled public appearances, including a speech to the Humane Society of California in Pasadena. He sent Elliot Lord $25 to keep the operation running, but the time between the men's letters grew longer and longer. In September of 1910, Duquesne wrote to Broussard, what have you that is new or valuable in the way of suggestion? If any, make them and I shall act. And Broussard replied, there is no news to communicate. And Duquesne wrote back, that it seems every day I hear of someone else that is not me, being the man who brought this matter before the people. I am working day in and day out to keep this matter before the people and at some expense too. He also explained there are half a dozen other writers wandering around stealing from his published works to pitch their own plans to import other animals from African countries. So there's a lot of copycats for this idea, too.
In other states, I take it? Other cities?
Other cities, other states, yes. Yes.
Ah, so he's afraid that someone is going to unwittingly expose his racket.
Yes, unwittingly expose his racket.
That's actually what... Because if he really cared about... what he was purporting to work towards, he would actually partner up with these people. If he was on the upper up and up.
Yes. And yeah. Also, remember what I said about Duquesne almost at the start of the episode was all the aliases that he used, right? Right? Now, eventually the plan to import hippos fell apart over the next decade because America became involved in World War I. And officials at the Department of Agriculture insisted that hippos were a terrible idea and that America ought to work instead to turn marshes into grassy pastures, which I'm not sure what would have been easier and less expensive. Would it have been easier to turn those swamplands into grassy pastures? I'm not even sure if that's possible.
Not so sure that's possible either. First time I heard that idea.
Now, it is believed that Duquesne and Elliot Lord were the same people.
Ah.
Right? No surprise to anybody.
Right.
I'm sure he was paying attention. Oh, wait. No, that sounded mean. I didn't mean it like that. But it did surprise me when I was reading about this that they were likely the same person. Now, Duquesne would go on to become arrested by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI for being the leader of the 33-person Nazi spy syndicate, the Duquesne Spy Ring, which included a Gestapo operative trying to to foment strikes amongst American workers, an aging male librarian, and a seductive figure skater named Lily Barbara Carola Stein. The Bureau accused Duquesne of coordinating the syndicate's communications with Germany, sending the Third Reich technical information about military gas leaks, fuel tanks, airplanes, and munitions, and plotting to start fires at American industrial sites.
And really, there hasn't been lots of talk about fascism in the United States.
Right.
People who were actually supportive of Nazi Germany and Hitler. It's rather inconvenient for companies like IBM and Ford.
Hugo Boss.
Yeah. Well, Hugo Boss was from Germany.
Oh, okay.
You see, that's a different story. Okay. Right. That was his country, just like Carl Walther of Walther Gun Company. He was German. Carl Walther was German, you see, and that was his industry, you see.
Right.
Just like Hugo Voss, you know, the designer of the SS uniforms. Hugo Boss, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he was German and that was his industry.
True.
You see, so right. It's kind of different. It's different than, say, Henry Ford with a manufacturing plant in Nazi Germany.
Right.
And suing the United States, and suing the, I think he sued the Department of Defense.
Did he really?
In, maybe it was still called the War Department at the time, Department of War. Yet he sued and got compensation for Ford factory that was damaged in bombing raid.
No kidding.
Yeah, which is really disgusting, and unfortunately, pretty much Ford has been allowed to live that down.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the company or the man, because the man's dead.
Well, the both.
Oh.
Yeah, both. Yeah, Hitler had a picture of Henry Ford in his office before the United States got involved in the war. He's a great admirer of Ford, and Henry Ford is a great admirer of Adolf Hitler.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, Ford fans, the truth hurts.
That's why you should you should maybe get a Kia instead.
Yeah, South Korea.
Yes. The 33 members of the Duquesne spy ring were sentenced to serve a total of more than 300 years in prison. They were found guilty in what historian Peter Duffy said in 2014 is still to this day the largest espionage case in the history of the United States.
Larger than the Walker spy ring of the 1980s.
Yes.
You had a family that had...
The John J. Walker spy ring.
Yeah, yes. The family that was... All had enlisted in the Navy and all were spying for the Russians.
They were. One German spy master later commented that the ring's roundup delivered the death blow to their espionage efforts in the United States.
Yeah, which I would assume wasn't very large.
No.
To begin with.
No, but apparently it was enough.
Yeah.
They could have really done a lot of damage.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme. It's one thing to have an isolationist attitude. And then another thing to, you know, during the 30s to actually admire Hitler and Nazi Germany. But then it's altogether something else to actually betray the country in time of war.
Now, Congressman Robert Broussard would die in 1918 at the age of 53, and his hippopotamus dreams were never realized. Fritz Duquesne died at City Hospital on Roosevelt Island in New York City on May 24th, 1956, at the age of 78. His remains were cremated and put into a potter's field. And Frederick Burnham died of heart failure at the age of 86 on September the 1st, 1947, at his home in Santa Barbara, California. He was buried at a private ceremony at Three Rivers, California, near his old cattle ranch, which was named La Cuesta. Today, groups of dedicated volunteers continue to battle water hyacinths. They're constantly moving through the waterways to remove the plants. And, you know, this, what I've said today on this podcast, really is just the tip of the iceberg of the lives of Fritz Duquesne and Frederick Burnham. They're both individually very fascinating characters. So I'm going to link articles in the show notes. And if you have a spare hour or two, read up on these people, because it's actually very cool to learn about who, I mean, these people who were going to bring hippo ranching to Louisiana. I mean, what a thing to be tied to. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, it's yet another example of failed ideas, failed endeavors, which are actually quite numerous.
Yes. But this was quite ambitious, but well, it was never realized, and we do not eat hippo in Louisiana.
No, never tried it.
No. I don't even think you could find it. Like, I know when you go into a supermarket, you can find things like shark. Sometimes you can find venison.
Mm-hmm.
But you will probably never see hippo meat in a supermarket.
No, not likely. No.
So we are going to return next week in spite of all of our hectic life things going on right now. We are going to return next week with another episode, and we are going to talk about a crime that you could really see both sides of, a crime that is infamous, and there's live, well, I'm sorry, there, the footage when it happened was live, but there is footage of it on YouTube, and I really look forward to discussing that case. I look forward to putting out that episode. And dear listeners, thank you for listening to us, and we will be back next week. So until then, be safe, be kind. Remember that we're all human beings, and remember that the gun that shot Buford Tannen was a Colt Peacemaker.
'Cause today I'd actually like to make some movie recommendations.
Okay.
It's time to close it out. Last night I took my sister to see the movie Babylon. Babylon was excellent, and it touches upon a rarely discussed topic that was previously touched upon in the movie Singing in the Rain. The failed attempts at silent movie actors to move into movies with you know, sound dialogue. And
they were called talkies back then, weren't they?
Yeah, they were first called talkies, and it really hasn't been, the topic's been really touched upon, and it's just fascinating that, you know, the movie Babylon brings this to life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, during the 1920s, you see this transition take place. You get this interesting glimpse at the silent film industry, like, in the beginning of the movie. You see this, like, outdoor soundstage area.
Okay.
That had, because they're all silent movies, there's multiple movies being filmed at the same time, and nobody cares about the noise.
Oh.
Because the movies are silent. And you even have, like, movies that had accompanying music.
Right.
Whereas you'd have an outside band playing, just like in the 12th episode of the Star Wars TV show Andor. Okay. Let's see. The movie Avatar, I went to see that also the previous week with my sister and brother-in-law, and that's an excellent sequel that actually builds upon the original movie, making something that's better than the original, okay? Because they further develop the storyline and, you know, new characters. It's the second generation, you see the second generation of mm-hmm. characters emerge, you know, the children. Okay, and
right.
Speaking of children, there's a surprise in that movie. I don't want to spoil for anyone. But, you know, I saw Avatar maybe twice, and I'm just a casual fan of it. And you know, the movie was much better than I was expected it to be. It was excellent, and you know, bravo to James Cameron again for once again
creating a spectacle.
Yeah, quite a spectacle. That is, you know, it's a visual. Yes, it is a visual bonanza. On top of that, James Cameron, bravo once again, developing an excellent character-driven story.
Yes,
that is just so much more than you expect going into it.
Well, you know, when you think about it, James Cameron has a career that spanned at least, what, 40 years at this point?
Yes.
Yeah, well, as long as we're going on movie recommendations right now, I have to say two of my favorite movies that I've seen in 2022 were The Menu. Love The Menu. I thought it was one of the best satire movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, dark satire, a very original for an Eat the Rich style movie.
Yes.
Although the movie is not what you think it is. Going in, the trailer has misdirectionals in it. Don't want to spoil it once again. It's still playing in some areas.
Yes.
But
and I do think it's on streaming as well somewhere. I think HBO might have it or something like that, because that is something about our modern world that I do kind of appreciate, because when I was younger, the movie would come out to a movie theater, and then you would have to wait, I think, at least a year for it to be on television. Not these days. These days, movies come to streaming a lot quicker than to view in your own home.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it would be, it doesn't have to go through all the filters that it used to have to go through. It's more streamlined.
I'd like to make another recommendation. The movie Devotion, which has Glenn Powell from Top Gun Maverick in it. He's one of the producers as well. It also has John Majors, who's really getting out there right now in Devotion and in the new Creed movie, and also in the new Ant-Man movie that's coming out. And he's a villain in that movie.
They're doing another Creed movie?
Yeah. And John Majors from
Devotion?
From Devotion.
And Top Gun Maverick.
And Top Gun. No, John Majors was not talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
John Majors was in Devotion.
Okay.
Now, another thing interesting, just like Top Gun Maverick, the aircraft in Devotion are actual 1950s era planes. The F-4U Corsairs are real in the flying sequences. The F-8 Bearcats are real. And even the Russian MiG-15 from the Korean War era is real and provided courtesy of Red Star Air Shows.
Very cool.
Yeah. Very, very cool. And that's very rare. I don't know how many MiG-15s are still flying today, but you can see one in the movie Devotion.
Yes. And the other movie that I want to recommend is Violent Night.
That was a
great movie. Just a very clever comedy.
Yeah, another dark comedy. It's, you know, you could tell it pays tribute to the movies Die Hard and Home Alone.
Yes.
So, and make no bones about it, this one is a Christmas movie. There's no argument as to whether or not Violent Night is a Christmas movie. It is most definitely a Christmas movie. And you could tell the producers of the movie intended this to be a Christmas movie. They did not depend on debate, like whether or not the movie Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
So I guess since our listeners are on the edge of their seats right now, we have to answer the question if we believe that Die Hard is a Christmas movie or not. I say it is.
I used to believe that. I personally don't think that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, just like the forgotten Steven Spielberg movie 1941, which is a comedy, which has cast members from the original SCTV and original Saturday Night Live, as well as you know, serious actors like Robert Stack, okay?
Yeah.
Is, you know, the movie 1941, I think it's a Christmas movie, although I've been told it's not. It's just simply a World War II comedy set during Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a role that, let's see, there were some notable actors who turned down, who turned Steven Spielberg down.
Oh, really?
Because they thought it was too early for a World War II comedy movie.
Ah.
Yeah. Huh. This is during the mid 70s.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that last part about it. Of course, I've seen 1941 a couple of times.
Because Robert Stack was not the first actor approached to play that part.
My other memory of Robert Stack, because for all of you youngins out there who might be listening to us, Robert Stack used to host a show called Unsolved Mysteries, which was a staple of my childhood. I would watch it every week. And he was also in the movie Basketball, where he had a cameo where he was doing his bit from Unsolved Mysteries, except he was talking about how one of the characters goes to Calcutta. And it's a very humorous bit, like when he says, according to, I forgot the lady's name, according to such and such, the nosy bitch who lives up the streets. It was like, and he just said it that very matter-of-fact way. It was very funny.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that's probably the funniest thing about that movie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, Brian, do you have anything to add before we officially sign off?
Yes. If you are, if it's dark, it's dangerous, you don't feel safe, don't be there in the first place. And if you are being questioned by law enforcement and you are not the victim or the witness to a crime, lawyer up.
And dear listeners, be safe, be kind, and drive carefully. Do not drive drunk.